This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thanks for tuning in to Eco Radio KC. On tonight's program, Bill McKibben of 350.org spoke at Pearson Auditorium on October 6th, courtesy of the Cockafair Chair Foundation. KKFI was on hand to record. But first, I'm Mike Murphy with these headline news compiled by Natural E. So Reuters reports that Paris authorities plan to banish all petrol and diesel-fueled cars from the world's most visited city by 2030. Paris City Hall said on Thursday. Paris City Hall said in a statement, France had already set a target date of 2040 for an end to cars dependent on fossil fuels, and this required speedier phase-outs in larger cities. Paris City Hall already under attack over the establishment of no-car zones, car-free days, and fines for drivers who enter the city in cars that are more than 20 years old, said it was not using the word ban, but rather introducing a feasible deadline by which combustion engine cars would be phased out. There are about 32 million household cars in France, where the population is about 66 million, according to 2016 data from the Argus, an automobile industry publication. And ENN.com reports that the economically important big bluestem grass, a dominant prairie grass and major forage grass for cattle, is predicted to reduce its growth and stature by up to 60% in the next 75 years because of climate change, according to a study involving Kansas State University researchers. The group of scientists, which include collaborators at Missouri Botanical Garden and Southern Illinois University Carbondale, had published the study in the peer-reviewed journal Global Change Biology. Big bluestem, or Andropogon gerardi, is a common grass in natural and restored prairies across the central Midwestern region that includes Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Iowa. The grass species is an important component of forage for the region's livestock industry. It is also commonly used in grassland restoration of prairies across several million acres in the Great Plains region. And EcoWatch.com reports that Ryan Zink's Interior Department is working hard behind the scenes to build a controversial and long-contested road through the heart of Alaska's Zembek National Wildlife Refuge. Documents show the refuge was established more than 30 years ago to conserve wetlands and habitats for migrating birds, brown bears, and salmon and other wildlife. 300,000 of its 315,000 acres has been designated as wilderness in 1980 under the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. The proposed 11-mile road would essentially bisect Azimbek to connect the towns of King Cove and Cold Bay. Proponents, including Alaska Governor Bill Walker, says the road is needed for medical emergency evacuations as King Cove's airport is inaccessible during inclement weather, forcing residents to use boats or helicopters. But refuge advocates fear the road would disrupt critical wildlife habitat and set a precedent to open wildlife refuges, national monuments, wilderness areas, and other public lands to economic development. The Center for Biological Diversity, the National Wildlife Refuge Association, and other environmental organizations have also warned that the project is about privatizing public lands for profit from a seafood venture. And let's see, we've also, EcoWatch.com reports that thousands of Adelie penguin chicks in Terra Adelie, Antarctica, died of starvation at the start of 2017 due to unusually thick sea ice that forced their parents to travel an extra 62 miles to find food, according to French scientists. The colony of over 18,000 pairs of Adelie penguins suffered a catastrophic breeding failure that left with only two chicks surviving at the beginning of the year. This is not the first time such an event has occurred. In 2013, just 4 years ago, the same colony, which numbered 20,196 pairs at the time, failed to produce a single chick. heavy sea ice combined with unusually warm weather and rain, followed by a rapid drop in temperature, resulted in many chicks becoming saturated and frozen to death, according to the World Wildlife Foundation. And that's it for the headlines. Thank you to Natural E for compiling those for me, for all of us. And so, as we said at the beginning of the program, Bill McKibben spoke, was the keynote speaker at the Cockafair Chair talk held at Pearson Auditorium at UMKC on October 6th. And we recorded it. We were unable to plug into a sound, any kind of sound. So we got to, it's a room recording, so there's a little bit of echo in there, but it's still worth hearing what Bill McKibben had to say. And I've omitted some of this, some of the talk, as well as Q&A, but all of that will be included in the podcast, which will be up shortly after this program. So that being said, let's go to Pearson Auditorium on Friday, October 6th.
Professor Cockafair sounds like she was quite remarkable. My aunt and uncle spent 40 years as the classics department at Grinnell College in Iowa, so I've always had a great ingrained respect for classicists of all kinds. And I'm also so glad that the Land Institute was part of this operation. Wes Jackson, who runs the Land Institute in Salina, is one of the great American heroes that there is, and if we make our way through this difficult century, it's his plant breeding may well be one of the things that helps us down that path. So, Anne, thank you so much for bringing me here. What a pleasure to be here with you all. Probably more of a pleasure for me than for you. Here we are on an absolutely beautiful late summer day. Now we're into the part of the year where we're sort of counting the late summer days that remain, you know, and instead of being out there and enjoying the sunset, you've been dragged inside to listen to someone whose essential profession is just bumming people out. That's my work in the world, and I apologize in advance, and I will try to get through the really bad part with some dispatch so that we can move on to matters a little more hopeful. But there is no point in talking about, unless we have some kind of common understanding of the scale and the pace of the problem that we face, then it's useless to try and talk about what set of solutions we should choose, because they're dependent on the scale and the pace of that problem. And the bad news is that, when I wrote The End of Nature almost 30 years ago, which I'm strikingly aware is before many people in this audience were born, we knew trouble was coming. I mean, we knew that when you burn coal and gas and oil, you put carbon in the atmosphere. We know its molecular structure traps heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. It's obviously only a matter of time before it heats up. What we didn't know was how fast that was going to happen and how hard it was going to pinch. And the story of the last 3 decades is it's come faster and pinched harder than even the most pessimistic people imagined in the late 1980s. And we're now at the point where we've raised the temperature of the planet about 1 degree Celsius, 1.7 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. That doesn't sound like an enormous amount, but it turns out that it's actually quite an astonishing amount of warmth. And you get a better sense of that maybe if you express it in other units. Each day, the extra heat that the carbon that we've emitted traps is the heat equivalent for about 400,000 Hiroshima-sized explosions. Okay? So that gives you some sense of the magnitude. Really, though, you can only really kind of understand the magnitude by looking at the effects, the things that have already happened. So, for instance, it's been enough heat to melt half or more of the summer sea ice in the Arctic. So think about that for a minute. This is a continent-sized patch of meters thick, millennia-old ice, and yet in the course of a couple of decades, we've managed to melt an enormous percentage of it. The world looks very, very different viewed from a satellite now than it did 40 years ago. It's as if the planet was a different planet in certain ways. The ocean, and we are, after all, an ocean planet. About 70% of the planet is covered by the sea. The ocean is entirely different, too, but you can't see it in the same way. As we've put that cloud of carbon in the atmosphere, some percentage of it has been absorbed by seawater. And as it's been absorbed, it's altered the chemistry of that seawater to the point where the ocean is about 30% more acidic than it was 40 years ago. Now, I was in the Pacific with our crew at 350.org in the Pacific spring before last, right as the big waves of warm water that accompanied the last big El Nino sloshed their way across the Indian and then the Pacific Oceans, and in so doing, in the course of a couple of weeks, managed to wipe out, depending where you were, 60, 70, 80, 100% of the coral reefs surrounding islands and atolls that had been there, well, forever, in our terms. The Great Barrier Reef off the coast of Australia is the largest living structure on our planet, but it's only half as living as it was 18 months ago. That 1 degree we've increased temperature has been enough to change dramatically what scientists would call the hydrological cycle on this planet, the way that water moves around the Earth. If you want one fact by which to kind of keep track of the 21st century, it's probably that warm air can hold more water vapor than cold. Okay? That explains why we see a dramatic increase in evaporation and hence drought in arid parts of the world. And that drought comes with severe consequences. I mean, even in the richest parts of the world, we have trouble dealing with it. So California endured a 5-year drought with disastrous consequences for its agriculture and for plenty of people who, by the end of it, were having to have water trucked into the towns where they lived in the Central Valley. Needless to say, it was the poorest and most vulnerable people that were hit hardest there. But at least in California, we have some kind of margin to provide, at least for the moment. When the deepest drought in the history of what we used to call the Fertile Crescent in Mesopotamia hit earlier in this century, it was enough to drive 1 million farmers off their land in Syria and into the cities in the course of a year. And the academic literature is now pretty clear that that was maybe the most important trigger factor for the Syrian civil war that in turn has triggered a kind of endless series of unrests and dispersal of millions of people out around the world, violence on a scale we don't even can hardly comprehend, and so on and so forth. That's what happens when you begin to upset the most basic parts of the natural order. We've seen in our neck of the woods in the last month one of the other effects. Hurricanes draw their power from the heat in the top few meters of the sea's surface. And as we've made the sea hotter, we've raised the possibility of larger, more intense hurricanes. September, we've just finished, set the record for the most hurricane activity, what scientists call accumulated cyclonic energy, in the Atlantic. Those records go back to 1851. Okay, so we're living through many kinds of records. And of course, we live today, you know, as Americans, in the sort of shadow of what happened in Puerto Rico. And our thoughts really need to be with people who right now are really desperate situation. They've been without power for weeks. Many of them have no access to water. Nothing that we talk about here will change that immediate reality. And so I hope when people go home, if you haven't already, and you probably have, you figure out some way to offer some real and material and immediate aid to people in real distress. And you might want to, if you're the praying type, just say a little prayer for the people in the path of the hurricane that's forming in the Gulf of Mexico as we speak this afternoon, Hurricane Nate. Which is a chipper-sounding name for what will likely be a nasty storm that will hit someplace in the Gulf tomorrow night. Even the most basic and obvious facts about life on the planet are now kind of up for grabs. It gets too hot now in the hottest places on the planet for people to really deal with it. We've set several times in the last 18 months the new record for highest reliably recorded temperature on planet Earth. In Basra, in Iraq, a big city in the south of Iraq, and in parts of Pakistan, the temperature has gotten to 129 degrees Fahrenheit, which is much too hot, obviously, for anyone to work or to sleep, and really too hot for any extended period for people to live. Your body just can't cool off enough at that temperature. And yet those are precisely the kind of temperatures that we're going to see more and more of, because the scary thing is we're still relatively near the beginning of this warming process. We've raised the temperature of the planet 1 degree Celsius so far, but we are on a path, even if everybody kept all the promises they made in the Paris Climate Accords, and of course, shamefully, our country, which has contributed more carbon to the atmosphere than any other country, has announced publicly that it's breaking its word and reneging on the promises that it made at Paris. Think about that for a minute. Think about whether it makes you feel good to be a citizen of this country at this moment. But even if we kept those promises and everybody else, we're still on a path to raise the temperature of the planet roughly 3.5 degrees Celsius in the lifetimes of the youngest people in this room. Okay? And if we raise the temperature 3.5 degrees Celsius, 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit, well, we can't have probably civilizations anything like the ones that we're accustomed to having. That puts absolutely everything at risk. It raises the sea past the point where our coastal cities can stay where they are. It makes it surpassingly difficult to raise the quantities of food we need for a planet with billions of people, on and on and on. It is the biggest thing that humans have ever done, and we have to bring it under control now. It is the most important task, not only that we face, but that humans have ever faced. All right, so now I've done the really bad part. You can take a breath and we'll go on. In fact, I'll give you a piece of good news, which is that we actually know what, at this point, most of what we need to do in order to prevent the very worst of this from happening. We can't stop global warming at this point. The fight is to try to keep it from getting entirely out of control. And to do that, of course, what we have to do is stop burning coal and gas and oil. That sounds easy to say, but 10 years ago, we really didn't know what would take its place, because those are the things that lie at the heart of almost every human action, from the moment you wake up until you go to sleep, at least. And the good news is that the engineers have done their job and done it with a vengeance and shown us what we could do. The price of a solar panel has fallen 80% in the last 10 years, to the point where it and wind energy are now the cheapest way to generate electrons in much of the world, even if no one asks coal and gas and oil to pay any price for the damage that they're, the almost incalculable damage they're doing to the planet. We can see this. You know, we can see the possibilities that weren't in a few places that are actually really tried to do this. For instance, Denmark. Denmark generated 50% of its power from the wind last year. Either that's because sly and crafty Danes have figured out a way to steal the world's wind supply for themselves, or it's because they've taken the same resources available to all of us and put them to use. I had the real pleasure of spending much of the spring in Africa, in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, and then across to East Africa and Tanzania, doing a piece for The New Yorker about the rapid spread of solar energy. We still have more than a billion people on this planet without access to electricity. There are more people without access to electricity now than there were when Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. Okay. Most of those people, the bulk of them, are in sub-Saharan Africa. And that, you know, if they were to wait for the grid to come the way that we have it, they would never, at least in human terms, it would be many generations before many of them privacy. Happily, in the last couple of years, that process is now changing fast because solar panels have gotten so cheap that people are able, for the same 30 cents a day that they were paying for enough kerosene to run one lamp that filled your room with a little bit of light and a lot of smoke, now that 30 cents a day, if you are able to finance it in the ways that people are figuring out how to do with sort of mobile money and things, is enough for a solar panel and a battery and four LED lights and maybe a little television. I was in a town in Ghana, right, you know, a couple of degrees off the equator, so it was 95 every single day of every single year. They just put in a little solar microgrid for the 40 or 50 houses in the community. So I was sitting there with all the elders of the community, old men mostly, and they kept handing me bottles of cold water, which I was grateful for. It was very hot, but it took me a minute in my clueless way to figure out why this was so important to them. It was so important to them because until 2 weeks ago, there had never been cold anything ever. Cold was a new concept here, thanks to the kind of true magic. I mean, if you think about it for a minute, there's a kind of just J.K. Rowling magic in the idea that we've figured out how you can hold up a plate of black glass to the sun, and out the other end comes cold and comes light and comes all the things of modernity. I mean, that is a miracle. So, the interesting question then is, we face the biggest crisis we've ever faced, and we have a solution at hand. Why are we not using it? Why are we progressing with infinite slowness to put these new technologies to work? Why are we not putting them, you know, doing everything we can to roll up? And it's that question really on which my life turned a little bit, I guess, 10 years ago or so. In that fine introduction, you made it seem as if, you know, I had done all this writing and all this activism and so on. That was kind, but really another way of saying it was, I wasted a great many years, having written The End of Nature, and I just kept writing more books and giving more talks and writing more articles, because that's, you know, I'm a writer, academic, that's what we like to do, and that's what we think matters most of the time, okay? And the theory was that if everybody kept doing this, that eventually we would win the argument and our leaders would start doing the things that leaders are supposed to do and make the sort of changes and move on. At a certain point, and it took much too long for me to figure this out, it became clear to me that that was not what was actually happening. We won the argument. The scientific community has been in rare and strong agreement since the mid-1990s about exactly what's happening and exactly what we need to do. No mystery about it. We won the argument. We were just losing the fight. Because the fight wasn't about data and reason and whatever. The fight, as fights almost always are, was about money and power. And the other side of that fight, the fossil fuel industry, was the richest force ever in human history. And they were using that money, and continue to use that money, to try and prolong their business model another couple of decades, even at the cost of breaking the planet. That sounds hyperbolic to say, and I'm not given to hyperbole, and I wouldn't have said it that way even a few years ago. But about 2 years ago, great investigative journalists at the Los Angeles Times and at the Columbia Journalism School and some other places started publishing a really some of the most important journalism in ever. A series of exposés based on documents that had been uncovered and on interviews with whistleblowing scientists about what the fossil fuel industry had known about global warming back in the 1970s and 1980s. And it turned out the answer was everything. Exxon, for instance, which was the biggest oil company, and in fact the biggest company, period, in the world for most of the last 50 years, the fullest, you know, articulation of our system. Exxon had studied climate change very seriously in those days. That makes sense. I mean, they had tons of money, they had some of the best scientists in the world, and their product was carbon. They wanted to find out what was going to happen. And their scientists told them what was going to happen. They told them how much it was going to warm and how fast, and those predictions were very spot on, and the company believed them. They started, for instance, building all their drilling rigs to compensate for the rise in sea level that they knew was coming. They began mapping out how they were going to bid for the parcels in the Arctic that they knew would soon melt, allowing them to go drill for oil. What they didn't do was tell any of the rest of us just the opposite. They invested hundreds of millions of dollars building the architecture of deceit and denial and disinformation. It's kept us engaged in utterly stupid debate for 25 years, a completely empty debate about whether global warming was real or not. Think about that for a minute. We've had this 25-year debate, even though both sides in the debate, science and the fossil fuel industry, knew going in what the answer was. Okay? We've just wasted a generation of time when we could have been actually addressing this problem. And the influence of that money, that much money and disinformation and stuff, eventually runs deep. I mean, we're now to the point where the President of the United States labors under the idea that climate change was a hoax invented by the Chinese. Right? That is, that's incorrect.
That's disturbing.
Unless the Chinese have some way of, you know, enlisting the polar ice sheets in their conspiracy. So, it's good that people are uncovering this. It's good that people like, I don't know, the Attorney General of New York State are now suing Exxon and things and trying to uncover more of it and bring it to light. But we're not going to change that, you know, we're not going to go back 25 years and reset the clock, unfortunately. It was about 10 years ago, though, that some of us began to realize that we were going to have to build our own power to try and take on that power from the fossil fuel industry. Now, you know, I say this, I mean, it's not as if I really had any idea about how to do that. I'm not an activist by training. You can tell by listening to me. I'm not a born orator. In fact, just the opposite. I'm a writer. Which means, well, I mean, writers are introverts. I mean, it's very nice to be here with you all, but really, I'd rather be back in my room typing. You know, that's what I like to do. But it was clear another book wasn't going to move the needle, so we decided we'd try and do something. And the we in this case, and I'd say this particularly for the students who are here. The we in this case was me and seven undergraduates at the college where I teach out in the sticks in Vermont. And we had no idea what we how to do this. We had no money or resources. We did take this name. My friend Jim Hansen, the greatest climate scientist that's ever lived, had just published this paper saying that 350 parts per million was the most carbon we could safely have in the atmosphere. So it was, that was an important number. But the reason we chose it really was because we wanted to organize globally, and we figured Arabic numerals would work better than English words. I mean, 350 means the same thing in Kansas City and in Kiev. But it was frankly ludicrous. I mean, there were 7 undergraduates. There are 7 continents. Each one took one. The guy who took the Antarctic also had to take the internet. And we set to work. And our work was to find other people like ourselves around the world. Now, there's not everywhere someone called an environmentalist. Okay? But there is everywhere someone who cares about public health or war and peace or development or hunger or women's rights or the things that we're not going to have on a rapidly degrading planet. And they were our kind of natural allies. And we asked everybody, first thing we did was just picked a day almost at random. And said, wherever you are, organize something that day to try and drive this understanding about climate change into the information bloodstream of the planet. Just sort of educational. And wherever you are, do this. I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, which means that I've spent an immense amount of my life going to potluck suppers. And that's sort of the Methodist sacrament. That was our kind of organizing. Everybody do something, where you are. Well, we didn't know how well it would work. We got the sense that it might work pretty well. We might have a chance. 2 days early, we told everybody to do this on a Saturday. Okay? But that Thursday, we were sitting around our little one-room office around our table, the 8 of us tapping away at all our last-minute things, and the phone rings. And it's our leader in Ethiopia. Look, all of us is a volunteer, like most of us is a she, like a surprising number of us is 17 years old, okay? And she's in tears. She's the government took away our permit for Saturday, so we're gonna do this today before they can stop us. That was brave, because Ethiopia, not always the kindest government to people who do what they're not supposed to. But that wasn't why she's crying. She just kept saying, we want to do this same day as everybody else. We wanted to be part of the whole big thing with everybody all over the world. We wanted to do it with everybody else. We're really sorry. We don't want to spoil it. We're really completely apologize. And we have 15,000 young people out in the street in Addis Ababa right now chanting 350. So we were all like, well, don't worry about the date. It's okay. We're good. And it was good. The next 48, 72 hours, there were 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries. And CNN said it was the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. And they were all over. I mean, the people were sending in pictures all over. The second one actually came from U.S. troops in Afghanistan. They made a 350 with sandbags, and they sent a note saying we're parking our Humvee for the weekend and walking. But mostly, they were coming in just from every corner. I can show you these pictures. This is almost a thread. I can show them to you for hours upon hours upon hours. They were coming from everywhere. The thing that was most interesting to me, watching them flood in, sometimes 10 and 20 a minute, was that I had always heard that environmentalism was something that rich white people did. And if you didn't know where your next meal was coming from, you wouldn't be an environmentalist, and on and on. And it took about 20 minutes of watching this to just realize what nonsense that was. Most of the people doing this work around the world were poor, black, brown, Asian, and young, because that's what almost all the world is composed of, okay? And it must be said, I've reflected a time or two since, that it's possible that it really is the other way around, that rich white people may be more of the problem than the solution to some of these troubles that we face. But just in passing, it was great to see everybody's wit applied to this problem. People had all sorts of good ways of expressing what was going on. It was the first big involvement of religious communities in this kind of fight. This was well before Pope Francis did his wonderful encyclical and things. So it was good to, I mean, that's a big multi-faith march in Cape Town, and there's the head of Muslim South Africa next to him, the kind of leader of indigenous traditions behind them, and the Scarlet, the Anglican Archbishop of South Africa. I'd been to the, that's a little hard to see, but I'd been to do some organizing in the Middle East. The Dead Sea is shrinking very rapidly as temperatures rise. People wanted to do something, but of course it's pretty hard. There's military barriers and checkpoints and stuff all over the place. So the Jordanians said, let's do the big three on our territory, our beach. The Palestinians said, we'll do the five in Palestine there. And the Israelis made their big zero there on the beach at Tel Aviv. And it was a beautiful take and a lot of press in that region because people don't normally figure out how to work together in quite those ways. 300 demonstrations in China that day, which is a hard place to do this kind of thing. But and a couple of them did get broken up by the police. China is incredibly interesting. They obviously copied us for a while and put up very quickly all kinds of coal-fired power plants and put a lot of carbon in the atmosphere. At the moment, they're the one country on Earth building renewable energy at an astonishing pace. I mean, they're just absolutely the ones who are figuring out how to do this. But China's a very interesting part of the story. Those are your brothers and sisters in the Maldives Islands in the Indian Ocean. That's the Student Government Association of the Maldives. And they're holding their meeting in the lagoon to illustrate the existential problem they face. The Maldives is more or less paradise. People have lived there for 5,000 years. It's an archipelago of islands sprung across the equator. It's all white sand beaches and coconut palms. It could not be more beautiful. But the highest point in the archipelago is about 5 feet above sea level, which is a bad place to be on a rapidly warming planet. They're fighting. Everybody's fighting everywhere. This was the biggest story on Google News for about 36 hours, and the reason was, I think, that people didn't look the way that newspaper editors thought environmentalists were supposed to look like. So there's Yemen, which is one hell of a tough place, it must be said. And all the women in that making that zero are in full black burqa, so they don't look to us like it's, you know, the meeting of the Sierra Club chapter or whatever. But their hearts are in exactly the same place. I mean, they're not thinking about themselves. They're thinking about the future and the rest of creation and whatever. There were 300 or 400 pictures that ended up in a file marked 350 adorable. They were adorable, and they're also, some of them, hard to look at. Those girls with the very big eyes are quite likely going to be refugees sometime in their life, and not because of anything they did, because of stuff we did. Climate change is, among other things, the greatest sort of justice challenge you can imagine. There's an almost perfect inverse relationship between how much of the problem you cause and how quickly you get bit by it. So we keep doing this work over and over and over again. We think we've organized about 20,000 of these demonstrations around the world in every country except North Korea, where we've had, for some reason, no luck. And it's been great fun. We've loved it and met so many people and gotten to be friends with and colleagues with people in places we've never heard of before, or, you know, places we heard of but for very different reasons, or you know, just on and on and on. It was great. And we've gotten to do all these huge art projects there. Here's a almost classical reference. That's 3,000 people making the blue raincoats, making the image of poor old King Canute trying to hold back the rising seas. We did this day when we did what they called it, the biggest art project in the planet's history. We did these things so big that basically we had to borrow satellites in order to get pictures of them. That's thousands of people making the image of someone escaping through the roof of a house in a flood, which sadly is an image we see a heck of a lot of now around the world. Scarab beetle is pushing solar panels across the Egyptian desert. that one might have been my favorite. It's a little hard to see maybe, but it's one of those arid riverbeds in the Southwest, now dried up for the most part. But when the satellite came over, a couple of thousand people put blue blankets up overhead for a second and just brought the river back to life. Kind of. It was very, very beautiful. Very. Now, if we had all the time in the world, this is all we would do. This kind of educational work, in essence, that helps people understand the problem and begin the process of making change. Because the best kind of change for all of us comes fairly slowly and evolutionarily. That's the way we should change, because it's less expensive, it's less traumatic. It's just, you know, how societies are designed. Our problem is we don't have 50 years. We had to start 25 years ago, and we didn't, and now we're way behind the eight ball. So we have to move much faster than is politically convenient, economically preferable, all else. I mean, we have to make haste like we never have before. So in this sort of building climate movement, we've had to learn how to be not just educational, but also somewhat confrontational. Okay. These are pictures from the beginning of the fight against the Keystone Pipeline in 2011, so 6 years ago. And you know, this was a proposed pipeline down from the tar sands of Canada. Now, we didn't think that we had any chance of stopping it, and no one else did either. National Journal, which is the trade paper for Washington, polled its energy insiders on Capitol Hill and K Street and things. And in August of 2011, and 93% of them said that TransCanada Company would have its permit for the Keystone Pipeline by the end of 2011. But we knew we had, even though we didn't think we could beat it, we knew we had to try, because there was so much carbon up there in those tar sands. So much that Jim Hansen, again at NASA, had produced a paper saying, if you burned all the economically recoverable oil up there in the tar sands, just from Alberta alone, you'd raise the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide from its current 402 parts per million to 540 parts per million, just from that one deposit. So, people came, we asked people to come to DC, and people came and they got arrested. And it was the biggest civil disobedience action about anything in this country in 30 years. 1,200 and some people went to jail, and that helped the kind of thing spread around the planet and then back to the White House, and you know, just really turned into the biggest environmental battle in many years. And President Obama a number of times said, well, I guess we'll delay this until after whatever election was coming next, and eventually he put the kibosh on it and said, we're not going to build this. Now, of course, Donald Trump wants to build it. His first day in office, he said, we're going to go build this Keystone Pipeline thing. We don't know what's going to happen. People are fighting hard in Nebraska to keep them from getting the permits. We'll probably get a decision sometime in the next couple of weeks. If Nebraska permits it, then there will be thousands of people along the pipeline route in the spring, waiting to get arrested again. The good news is, for 7 years now, we've kept 800,000 barrels a day of the dirtiest oil underground, dirtiest oil on Earth. And more to the point, people watched that thing and began to understand that even though big oil had all the money in the world, you actually can stand up to them. And it's kicked off this kind of endless series of challenges to every project of the fossil fuel, every new project that the fossil fuel industry dreams up now, people oppose and oppose hard, and a lot of the time we win. We had, I'm just thinking of the last few days. Last week, 4 years ago, there had been proposals for six giant coal ports along the Pacific Northwest to take coal from the interior of the country to Asia. As of last Thursday, we defeated the sixth and final one of them. Great organizing by people in Oregon and Washington. Beginning of this week, Scotland became the, I don't know, 20th or 21st country or something on the planet to ban fracking. Yesterday, TransCanada, the same country, the company that's trying to build the Keystone Pipeline, announced that they've withdrawn their plans for an even bigger pipeline out of the tar sands through Canada to the Atlantic, the so-called Energy East Pipeline. Huge victory for people who work so hard up there in Canada and elsewhere. We don't win every fight, but we make it really hard for them now at every turn, because we have to keep this stuff in the ground. There's way, way, way more carbon in the known reserves of the fossil fuel industry than we can burn and have any hope, even of meeting the not very good targets we set at Paris. It has to stay in the ground. Whether or not we're going to get there in time, I don't know. Fighting now. So here's what I really want to say. The planet is way outside its comfort zone. Okay, that's what it means when the biggest physical features on Earth are melting or bleaching or drying up and catching on fire or whatever. The planet is way outside its comfort zone, so we better get outside ours. The things that we're doing so far, the small steps that we're taking, are not enough. They are not adding up anywhere near fast enough to deal with the problem that we have. Okay? It's important that everybody go home and do the right thing with their light bulb or their car or whatever. I mean, you saw my house, it's got solar panels all over the roof, and I drove the first electric Ford in the state of Vermont, on and on and on. Don't try to fool myself that that's actually how we're going to beat this problem. We are so far behind that the only hope is for people to stop worrying about their individual actions very much, and in fact stop being quite so individual, and come together in groups large enough to change the basic policies and politics and economics around climate, to put a price on carbon, to have widespread, powerful support for the kind of renewable build-out that we need around the country, one that would produce huge jobs and so on, but that is going to take some real leadership to make happen. Support for making sure that we keep in the ground all the coal and gas and oil that we possibly can. Those are the things we have to work on. And we have to work on them hard. I don't know exactly what going outside one's comfort zone will mean for each person. But I was thinking, as I was looking at those slides, I was thinking about the when we started that fight against the Keystone Pipeline. I was the one who had to write the letter, ask people to come get a respite in Washington. Not an easy letter to write, really. But one of the things I said in it, and I say this looking around the wonderful age diversity of this audience, one of the things I said in it was, I did not think that young people should have to be the cannon fodder for this part of the fight. As you can tell from these pictures, young people are doing most of the leading around the world. They've done a great job. That's, we're at 350. I mean, I'm twice as old as the next oldest person at 350, for their staff. But if you're 22, it's possible that an arrest record is not the best possible thing for your resume, okay? One of the unmixed blessings of growing older is, past a certain point, what the hell are they going to do to you? It was with pleasure that we watched people with hairlines like mine descending on D.C. We did not say, how old are you? Because that would be rude, but cleverly, and we said, who was president when you were born? And the two biggest cohorts came from the FDR and the Truman administrations. On the last day, there was a guy arrested with a sign around his neck that said, World War II vet handled with care. He was so old that he'd been born in the Harding administration, which was so long ago, I've really forgotten there was a war in the administration. It was great. The young people there actually got to see their elders acting the way that elders probably need to act in a working civilization. So it was quite moving. The other thing we told everybody was, if you want to come get arrested, we need you to wear a necktie or a dress. Okay? I wore a necktie today out of respect for you all, but I don't wear one very often. I mean, in Vermont, where I come from, I think there's part of the Constitution that you don't have to wear a necktie. But we wanted to make the visual point that I've sort of been trying to make all through this talk. And that is, there's nothing radical at all about what we're talking about. Not in the least. I mean, all people are saying is, we'd like a world that works a little bit like the one that we were born onto. It still has some little bit of ice at the top and bottom and the odd coral reef in between, and where it's not so hot that you can't grow wheat and corn and things in the interiors of the continents. That's not a radical, that's a deeply conservative demand to be making. You know. And you start to realize that really radicals work at all companies. If you're willing to get up in the morning and alter the chemical composition of the atmosphere, and you're willing to do it after scientists told you what will happen, and you keep doing it after what the scientists told you would happen happened, okay, then you're a radical on a scale we've not dealt with before. Forget about like people in the 60s or whatever. This is some utterly different thing that we're talking about. And our job is to figure out how to check that radicalism if we can. Since I began by being frank, I'll end by being frank. It's not 100% sure at this point that we're going to win. Not even close to 100%. You know, most of the time when we're fighting for important things, we do know that eventually we're going to get there. Dr. King, who's my particular hero, would end every talk he gave. He'd quote, I think, from the abolitionist Theodore Parker. He'd say, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. This may take a while, but we're going to get there. Okay? The arc of the physical universe is short, and it bends toward heat. Okay? And so if we do not win soon, we do not win. Winning slowly on climate change is another way of losing. All right? And it's possible that we've waited too long already. It's not a good sign when the ice caps start to melt. You know? At 402 parts per million CO2, there is more CO2 in the atmosphere already than there has been for 800,000 years on this planet. The best science indicates that a window remains open from which to forestall the worst consequences, but it is a pretty narrow window and it is closing. And so it is our job to try and keep it open long enough for people to keep this fight alive. Can't guarantee that we're going to win, but I can guarantee you, you have reason to trust me, having seen these pictures, I can guarantee that there's going to be a fight. All over the world, people are engaging in that fight. As we meet here today, there's people meeting in 100 other rooms like this one, planning what they're going to do to whatever it is in their community, wherever they are on the planet. And it's been though I am an introvert, it's been the great honor of my life to get to be with a lot of those people in a lot of places, wherever it is, you know, including in jail. And I'm so grateful to those of you who are already engaged in this fight, and so grateful for those of you who will join in a serious way going forward. It will just be a privilege to stand shoulder to shoulder with y'all. Thank you very much. Longer than I should. I get going, and I like looking at the pictures. No moral opprobrium will attach to anyone who decides they'd like to go out and get some fresh air. But if there are people who want to have a question or two, or a abusive critique, or whatever, that would be fine, and I'll try to deal with it. So, there's mics. Apparently, there's microphones.
There's one over here as well.
Here and here.
So we have 5 to 7 minutes for questions.
We'll go fast. You far away.
First off, thank you very much for your work, sir. You've been a personal inspiration to me. Just want to two words that I think that you very carefully avoid, that I think you talk around a lot. I'm just interested in thinking about not using them. Two words are capitalism, which I think is the root of the problem, and extinction, which is what we will see if we fail.
Sure.
In my opinion.
So I doubt that humans will go extinct, but I have no doubt that a lot of other things are going to in the course of this century. And I think that an enormous number of people are going to suffer an enormous amount, and that they're almost universally going to be the people who did the least to cause the problem. And it would be it already is a humanitarian crisis on a scale that we haven't dealt with. As for capitalism, sure. I mean, one of my closest colleagues in this work has been on the board of 350 from the start, who came up with the divestment fight with me, is Naomi Klein, who's wrote a book that people should really read, a book called This Changes Everything, which talks a lot about this. So I guess the way that it, here's how it looks to me. The most interesting subversive, I don't see a method at the moment for overturning everything in our system. If that's what we have to deal with climate change, then I doubt it will happen in the short time that we have, okay? I mean, I'm all for everybody doing it. I spent much of the last 2 years off with my good friend and Vermont neighbor, Mr. Sanders, out working hard, you know? But I think the single most subversive thing we can do, probably, is switch quickly off coal and gas and oil and to renewable energy. And the reason is because so much of the unfair concentrations of political and economic power in our world are linked to the fact, I mean, they belong to the people who happen to reside over or somehow control the small patches of coal and gas and oil on Earth. Ask yourself how the Koch brothers came to dominate our political life. Okay? It's because they're the taken together the richest man in the world, because they control oil and gas pipelines across North America. They're the biggest leaseholders in the tar sands of Canada. Every solar panel that we put up undercuts that kind of power. Okay? Undercuts the power of the biggest corporations on the planet. To me, more important than ideology usually is sort of facts on the ground. That is to say, Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, the Burr text of capitalism, after James Watt invented the steam engine, not before. And if we're able to take control of one of the most important commodities on Earth, energy and food are probably the two, if we're able to take control of one of those and move it close to home, because sun and wind are ubiquitous on our planet, then we will have struck a fairly deep blow against a lot of the kind of inequities of power on this planet. So in my sort of, one of the things that worrying about climate change enforces is a kind of brute practicality. I think we have to try and find the flaws in the Death Star, as it were, you know, and I think that's, at the moment, the deepest one, because we have no choice but to do something about climate change. That's my sense.
Well, thanks for being here. I think you were here a few years ago, and let's see. Now, I don't know how we're going to get there, but I have two visions, you might say. One is this country and Western countries turning around like they did in World War II, changing the whole economics and the factories, the industry. I mean, as radical as that, I foresee that happening because we're going to need to, and everybody's going to know it. So I see that happening. And then the other thing is that kind of leadership that's going to bring that about, like an FDR or something. I don't know how this is going to happen.
So that's really good. I wrote a piece last year. You can find it on the web. The New Republic magazine. One piece. That was precisely the point I was making. That we need to be on a kind of wartime footing. In fact, I talked a lot about it, went into a lot of the detail, did a lot of research about exactly how we changed the manufacturing base in this country in the course of 8 or 10 months. To move it from making cars to making the things we needed for World War II. It was an amazing undertaking that the government had to run. And of course, FDR was a crucial figure. Now, you know, we may not get an FDR, in which case, we better figure out how to do this some other way. We don't have a great, for the environmental movement, say, we don't have a great deal. We don't have the equivalent of Dr. King or something. That is a problem, maybe. Maybe we'd be doing better if we did, but it's where we are. And so the good news is that we have a very dispersed, we have a movement that looks like the architecture of the future that we're trying to build. We want 10 million solar panels on 10 million roofs all interconnected, right? And that's what the movement that we've been building, that's what the pictures you've been looking at are like. So instead of having a great leader, we have a kind of leaderful movement. And who knows, maybe out of that an FDR will come, or maybe out of it we'll figure out how to make it work in some new way. The architecture of dispersal and distribution for power, for energy, for information and the internet, for many of that seems to be the architecture of the 21st century. And there are times when I think more decentralization of almost everything is good. I confess, I amused myself the last year by writing the first novel I ever wrote. It comes out next month, and it's about Vermont seceding from the Union. It's mostly a comic novel. I'm not always quite as depressing as I was today. Thank you for that. Good question.
Nathaniel Batchelder, I'm from Oklahoma City, and Bill, I've followed you since 1989 when the Atlantic Monthly ran 30 pages of The End of Nature, and I've read The End of Nature, and I've done my best to do all the kinds of things that you inspired us by talking about tonight, and those moving pictures from around the world, the resistance, the demonstrations, the civil disobedience, the events, the civil disobedience that was done in Oklahoma against the KXL pipeline. Yep. So, absolutely everything you've talked about is what we all must be involved with in between elections.
Yep.
And somehow we're going to have to hitch up our pants and figure out how to win elections. If we can't elect the best, at least we can defeat the worst.
Yep.
And I know hundreds of idealistic people in Oklahoma who are so principled and ethical that if they voted at all, they would not vote for a Democrat, much less a Republican.
So I take my...
Their votes were needed to change. We got a country run by one party that agrees with Trump and Pence and Senator Jim Inhofe, my senator, and Scott Pruitt and Jim Bridenstine, who've just been appointed to the EPA and NATO, who don't believe in climate change.
I hear you. So I take my own political cues. As you can tell, most of my work is outside the halls of power, and I think, in a sense, that remains the most important work. The prize for activists is to change the zeitgeist above all, and if you can accomplish that, as people did say around gay marriage, then you can get legislative and policy change fairly quickly. But elections are an important part of that. I must say, just because I live in Vermont, I take my cues from Mr. Sanders. I think he played it just right, you know. pushed things hard as he could, and then when the time came, I remember we were trying to get him to come out to Standing Rock in the end of October last year, and he said he was about to do it, and then the last thing he said, well, they told me to go to 11 states in 4 days for Hillary, you know, and work his tail off. I spent much of last fall in Ohio and Pennsylvania doing the same. The good news is, every place I go in the country now, I meet people who are inspired by that campaign, the Sanders campaign, who are now running for office everywhere. And I don't mean just running for the Senate. I mean running for the city council and the public utility. If you wanted to run for anything that has a lot of leverage, run for the public utility commission. And it's really exciting to see. So you're right. On odd number of years in the fall, that's what we stop and work on for a little while. Okay? But we don't wait for great. I mean, that's a part of the process. And an important one, but it's in the end, and we probably have to stop here, right?
That's and we want you to be able to sign in the end as well.
In the end, that zeitgeist is the question. That's where we try to go. That's why we do all this work. And though things are bad and bleak in a sense at the moment with Mr. Trump, it must be said that the polling data indicates that more and more Americans, with each passing month, understand that we are in a real problem with climate change. And that's good. Whether we'll move fast enough depends entirely on how fast we move, how much energy we put into building this kind of movement. So, thank you all.
Thank you.